On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The war in Iraq is in a heap of trouble, and the war in Afghanistan has seen better days, too. But the war of words out of Washington, aimed at al-Qaeda and a whole lot more, has never been hotter. And the big word of the moment is fascism, more specifically Islamofascism. The neocons have used it for years. Now it's front and center in the rhetorical toolkit of the President of the United States.
This is the beginning of a long struggle against an ideology that is real and profound. It's Islamofascism.
Islamofascism, Islamic fascism, and all the images that tumble in behind. Hitler, Mussolini, Nazis, brown shirts, world war, global struggle, American victory. The White House says this is the hard truth. Critics say it's bald politics and bad strategy. Up next on Point, al-Qaeda, Bush, and Hitler will test the Islamofascism line. Joining me first today from London is historian and eminent political scientist Walter LeCour. He is the world's preeminent scholar, perhaps, in the study of fascism. He's written and edited widely on the topic, including his landmark book, Fascism, Past, Present, and Future. Mr. LeCour, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, thank you.
Can you help us first, if it's possible, is there a definition for fascism? How do you describe fascism? You're the top expert.
I may be the expert, but there is no definition for the simple reason that fascism differs from country to country. There is no common denominator. There are certain common features. There is what the experts call a fascist minimum, such as, well, opposition to democracy, a political party, one single political party, state terrorism, state propaganda, opposition to liberalism, its expensive and aggressive character. All these things mark most fascist parties or governments.
Is fascism a 20th century creation, development?
Yes, it is.
So does it really mean, you know, just point to Mussolini, point to Hitler, and there you have fascism?
Well, look, even if you would have called, if you would have told Hitler that he's a fascist, he would probably have protested, because the conditions in Italy were quite different from those in Germany. This is very confusing, but that's a fact.
Now we have not a state exactly, but a whole array of foes and potential foes here. President Bush is using this big label across a very broad spectrum, fascist. Walter LeCour, does it make sense to you?
Well, you can discuss it on two different levels, on the level of political science, and there probably it wouldn't make much sense. Because the situation in the case of al-Qaeda and Iran, religion plays a very important role. By the way, there were also fascist movements which were religious, but that's a different story. If on the other hand, unfortunately, it has become the fashion to call fascism any movement which one dislikes. And this incidentally began on the left, not on the right. When President Roosevelt came to power and launched the New Deal, the communist papers were calling it fascist. When Barry Goldwater was running for president, again, he was in certain quarters attacked as a fascist. So,
if you plug Ronald Reagan and fascism into Google, I'm reading here, you'll get 1.8 million references
exactly,
popping up.
Exactly. So this, unfortunately, by the way, another point which frequently is forgotten, while fascism is certainly a very offensive term in Europe and in the United States, It's much less so in the Middle East, where fashia, which is Arab word for fascism, is not such a horrible thing. It's not a big deal. On the contrary, there was and is to a certain extent considerable admiration for Hitler and Mussolini.
Let me ask you, if I may, you said there have been religious fascist movements, but that's a different story. But maybe it's not a different story, since religion, when you say Islamic fascists, you've got religion right in the middle of that. What have been the examples of religious fascism that you would point to?
Well, an example was, for instance, in Austria, in Romania, in various other countries, which were, in these movements, the influence of the church was very strong. But there is a difference, because Germany and Italian were anti-religious, anti-Christian, the supreme authority was the leader. And in the case of the Muslim countries, of course, the supreme authority is God, is Allah.
You wrote in your book, Fascism, Past, Present, and Future, this is perhaps a decade ago now, you wrote, I'm quoting you here, clerical fascism, well, at least that. Anyway, you said combining radical militant Islamic fundamentalism with dictatorial government, widespread use of terror, anti-Western propaganda is a colossus on feet of clay. But yet you use the phrase clerical fascism, religiously oriented fascism. Is it possible that there's a new breed of fascism? Is it possible Bush is right? It's not like Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy, but fascist nevertheless.
It is possible, but you see, most people in the field who have studied will tell you that fascism, really as we know it, came to an end in 1945 with the Second World War. Of course, you have neo-fascists, you have all post-fascist movements, which are in some respects very similar. And I think I was among the first who was to point to it, to similarity. So to that extent, what Bush said is not entirely far-fetched. There are similarities, there are parallels.
You've been called a neoconservative yourself. I don't know what you make of that label. We're going to hear voices in this hour.
Nonsense. I wasn't a neoconservative. I've never been made an offer. I've never been consulted. So let's forget about it.
Well, fine. Be that as it may, we're going to hear voices in this hour that absolutely insist that fascism is the right term and that there's no choice but a kind of duel to the death. What do you say to that view that insistently puts the fascist label around this threat? How do you interpret that?
Well, the fascist label is not entirely wrong, but nor is it entirely right. And if I am not mistaken, the president in yesterday's speech, he mentioned Hitler, but he also mentioned Lenin.
Yes, he did.
Lenin, I believe, was not a fascist.
Mm-hmm. Does it help? You're looking on from Europe. It's a different vantage than the United States. And it's not your job to keep the United States secure, but do you think this is a helpful characterization in the conflict or conflicts that clearly are going on?
Helpful or not, I don't think that was the intention. Politicians are not professors of political science. And I don't think they are... what he wanted to convey, obviously, was that this was a very bad and a dangerous regime or movement. And these fine differences, whether it conforms with the fascist minimum, that's for the academic world to decide. I think this was a kind of, in a speech, all kinds of things are said which are not necessarily meant to clarify and to define.
You talked about fascism being characterized by opposition to democracy, one party, and then state terrorism. You said, what about non-state terrorism, which is perhaps more pertinent today? Is statehood required for a fascist entity to exist?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
Does it have to be a state? Does it have to be state-based? Because stateless forces at work here as well.
Look, most fascist groups never came to power. They came to power only in Germany and Italy. And in many other countries, there were fascist movements, small, medium, large, which never came to power. So fascist group need not necessarily be a state and state power.
When you look at the any number of challenges to the United States, at the least, al-Qaeda may be foremost among them, but others as well, is there one broad label that you could or would put on all of them, Walter LeCour?
No, there's not one broad label, because even religion doesn't define them, because it's a mixture of extreme, it's religious fanaticism on one hand, but it's also nationalism. It is a number of things. It's populism, whatever. There are various ways to call it. But there is, again, there is not one single label which you could affix and say that's it.
A good idea for President Bush to use this language or not?
I don't think it matters that much, because, too, it doesn't clarify the character of the movement. For that you need articles and books and but nor does it do such great harm, as I said, because in the Middle East, in the Muslim world, the term fascism is not such an opprobrium.
It has certainly raised some hackles here in the United States. We appreciate your perspective from Europe today. Walter LeCour, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, used this kind of language just last week, speaking before the American Legion in Salt Lake City, August 29th.
Once again, we face similar challenges in efforts to confront the rising threat of a new type of fascism. Today, another enemy, a different kind of enemy, has made clear its intentions with attacks in places like New York and Washington, D.C., Bali, London, Madrid, Moscow, and so many other places. But some seem not to have learned history's lessons.
A new type of fascism, says Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Islamofascism, Islamic fascists, says President George W. Bush. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. Is this the right framing for what we're up against? I'm joined from Washington by Stephen Schwartz. He's a contributor to the Weekly Standard, executive director of the Center for Islamic Pluralism, author of The Two Faces of Islam. His forthcoming book is It Good for the Jews? The Crisis of America's Israel Lobby. Stephen Schwartz, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with us from Berkeley, California, Michael Parenti, a political scientist. He's taught at Sarah Lawrence College, State University of New York, and University of Canterbury in New Zealand, author of many books, including Black Shirts and Reds, Rational Fascism and the Overthrow of Communism. Michael Parenti, thank you for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
Stephen Schwartz, first to you. You have said it's Islamofascism and it's a struggle to the death. Why this framing?
Well, when I developed the concept of Islamofascism, first of all, it wasn't a soundbite. It wasn't intended to support anybody's political campaigns or political arguments. It was an attempt by myself and a small group of Muslim intellectuals, mainly in the Balkans, but also in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere.
You're Muslim yourself?
Yes, I'm Muslim myself. I became Muslim in Bosnia in 1997.
Okay.
And it was an attempt by us to understand the phenomenon of really actually rather limited phenomenon at the beginning, but which unfortunately became a much larger phenomenon, and that was the phenomenon of Wahhabism, the official state interpretation of Islam in Saudi Arabia, the role of Wahhabism in the Sunni Muslim world, and then the role of Wahhabism and the Saudi kingdom in the creation, the support of Al-Qaeda. It is, in my view, a narrow and intellectually rigorous concept that draws a parallel between German Nazism and Italian fascism on one side and Saudi Wahhabism, and to a much lesser extent, some Shia phenomena on the other. And it's based on basically three common points, which are a little different from Zev LeCour's points. One is it's based on the frustrations of the middle class. Saudi has the largest middle class in the Arab world right now.
And you're saying there's a parallel there in Hitler's Germany, Mussolini's Italy.
Yes. The second is that this radicalized, and it is radical, it's radicalized because Saudi is not really a conservative Islamic state. It's a radical Islamic state.
The state itself.
Yes. I view the, at the present time, there's a struggle going on toward a transition, but The Saudi monarchy rests on Wahhabism, which is no longer really an interpretation of Islam. It's now a state ideology.
I just want to note there that you're pointing to American allies, the House of Saud, not to Al-Qaeda. But let's just put that aside for a second. Your second point, radicalized state. And third?
Second point is the thing that all three of them have in common, which is magical thinking, conspiratorialism, blaming the problems of the Islamic world on the Freemasons, the Jews, viewing the United States as conducting a crusade against Islam, et cetera, et cetera. The third is the willingness to employ violence against the established legal and political system. The thing that distinguishes fascism from authoritarian dictatorships or extreme conservative movements is the extreme conservative movements and authoritarian dictatorships attempt to preserve the existing system.
Mm-hmm.
The fascists and Nazis did not, they based their rise to power on basically street warfare. They went out in the streets and they fought against their political enemies, and they even fought against the established system to a certain extent.
Let me ask you one question, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
And I want to turn to Michael Parenti then. But we just talked with Pat Buchanan last hour about immigration. But on another front, on this front, Pat Buchanan wrote recently, and here's a conservative of a different stripe than the neoconservatives. People may call him a paleoconservative. Anyway, more old-fashioned. Pat Buchanan wrote about the neoconservatives using this phrase, and you write at the Weekly Standard, where neoconservative publication. He says, this is Pat Buchanan, their goal is to have Bush stuff Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran into the same Islamo-fascist kill box, then let SAC, the Strategic Air Command, do the rest. But he goes on to say, but the term represents the same lazy, shallow thinking that got us into Iraq, where Americans were persuaded that by dumping over Saddam, we were avenging 9/11. You described a narrow target for your fascist label. Has it been drawn over broad or not?
Well, I can't be responsible for what other people do with the label, and I must say being called lazy and shallow by Pat Buchanan is a little bit like being called ugly by Frankenstein's monster.
We won't pin this on you, but you take the broad criticism. What do you say to it?
It's no. In my view, it is a narrow term that should be used to refer to Al-Qaeda, to the extreme reactionary wing of the Saudi monarchy, to the movements in Egypt and Pakistan that emulate Wahhabism, and to a very limited extent certain groups in Iran.
So has Bush gone too far?
Extent in Syria. Well, I don't take responsibility for what Bush does. I mean, Bush can
say
whatever
he wants. I'm not asking you to be responsible. I'm asking you to assess what he's done. Has he gone too far in wrapping this label over the entire, you know,
he's the president of the
Megillah.
United States. He delivers political speeches. He doesn't deliver political science or philosophical lectures. I think that he has, I don't have a problem with calling Al-Qaeda or other radical groups that engage in terror against civilians fascist groups. I would disagree if I was to have a debate with President Bush on the fine points of the theory. I'm sure there are areas where we would disagree.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn, if I may, to Michael Parenti in California. Michael Parenti, Islamofascism, Islamic fascist, is this accurate? Is this useful?
Well, obviously, the way it's being used by the president and his associates is rhetorical. It's a highly charged word, and it's ahistorical. But I think the question, Tom, might be is why are they suddenly leaping on this term and using fascism and this? I think terrorism is becoming a rather worn and overused term. I think the White House even said we're not going to call it a war on terrorism anymore. It's getting flat and people are really getting demoralized about the war in Iraq and all that. So they've got to escalate the rhetoric to justify the invasion and occupation. And the way you do that is you demonize the leaders and the country in order to keep attacking it. You know, Bush Sr. did that back in 1990. He said, Saddam Hussein is worse than Hitler. He's a threat to Europe the way Hitler never was, and he has to be dealt with.
But worse than Hitler is a different thing than saying these are Islamic fascists. And I hear we've got a number of academics with us today. You're all saying this is just rhetoric. But, you know, it's the American people the president's speaking with here. So we can't throw it away as rhetoric. I mean, real Americans died fighting fascists, lots of them.
And I didn't say throw it away, but look at the fascism historically was a pseudo-revolutionary mass movement. But it was designed to break the left, break mass organizations, destroy mass democracy, and break labor unions, cut the taxes for the very rich, and support and subsidize the German and Italian cartels. And that's what it did.
Is Al-Qaeda a new form of fascism, in your view? Or, for that matter, Hamas, Hezbollah?
It doesn't do those. But yeah, you could call them fascists in this ahistorical, rhetorical. There's a second meaning to the word fascism, the way it's used by everybody today, meaning a brutal, a dislike, a horrible, violent group, autocratic. You know, this dictator's a fascist. That one's a fascist. This guy's a fascist. In that sense, you could qualify for fascism. But it's interesting when you link the two terms, Islamic fascism. It's kind of unfair to Islam. You know, when Timothy McVeigh blew up 168 fellow Americans in Oklahoma City and was part of a Missouri right-wing religious Christian cult, nobody started using the term Christian fascists or, Christo-fascists or whatever, Cristano-fascists, whatever you want to call it.
So you're saying be careful here, not quite so easy. Stephen Schwartz, I want to get your response to that, but a lot of listeners want to join us as well. If I may, let me turn to Frank in Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Frank. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What do you think?
Well, one look at the back of my vehicle would convince anybody that I'm no fan of the present administration. However, even a broken clock tells the right time twice a day, and I think President Bush has it absolutely right on this one.
Make the case.
Well, I think that I'll take the view of English that a word is what people use it to mean, and since I'm not an intellectual and not an academic, but the word meaning oppressive dictatorial control through means of terror and censorship, I think that very much these governments and some of these governments and many of these organizations qualify. That is how they rule. They want to impose a single idea of thought, and anybody that stands in their way will be trounced in whatever manner they see fit.
Stephen Schwartz says it's a struggle to the death, us or them, in democracy versus fascism. Do you see it that way?
Well, I see that. I
just want to ask Frank, if I may, Stephen. I apologize. Frank, how do you see it?
How do I see it? I see that, well, I don't see that we need to, fight every single Islamic government in the world, obviously, and I certainly don't agree with the tactics that our administration has used. But I believe that we have true enemies in this world, and I don't think we can sit down at the table and discuss all these all the time. Do I think invading Iraq was a good idea? No, but I think that there are going to be some very difficult choices and some hard choices and some unfortunately violent choices that are going to need to be made in the future.
So there's sympathy for the phrase from a man who's got a No Thank You Bush bumper sticker on the back of his car. Let me get a call from Salem, New Hampshire. Sultan is on the air. Hi, Sultan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Sultan?
I think as the election comes closer, the record goes higher and higher. It's more political than anything else. To me, it's like, when anybody's in trouble, then you start using these terms like Rick Santorum. He's using these kind of words all the time because he's in trouble now.
Sultan, are you Muslim? How do you feel when you hear the phrase Islamo-fascism?
Well, it's terrible because it really affects my children in schools, my work at a place, or a lot of people that will become like a blanket thing that label use, and the people then start thinking about everybody then. So very, very irresponsible. It's like a Bush is doing like a guy who lost all his quarters and start, in the slot machine, and now he's kicking the slot machine because he lost all the quarters.
Kicking the slot machine. But let me ask you, President Bush would no doubt say, Sultan, I don't mean you, my good American friend. I mean those other bad Muslims. How do you respond to that?
He can some once in a while also say good things about Islam, but that doesn't do that, maybe once in a whole 4 years. So compensate with what is using those to at least do something other things that they can compensate for the bad press that we, the Muslims are getting.
Sultan, we hear it, and we wish you well. Thanks for calling. Let me turn for just a moment here to Fawaz Jerges, who joins us from Madison, New Jersey. He's holds the chair in Middle East and International Affairs at Sarah Lawrence College, author of Journey of the Jihadist. Fawaz Jerges, welcome back to One Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What do you make of the emergence of this phrase as kind of the lead hood ornament on the Bush administration's description of this conflict, the heir to war on terror, war on Islamo-fascism?
Well, Tom, I think it's basically a polemical slogan. It's a rhetorical slogan which resonates with many Americans. If you press me harder, I would say it's a public relation device to really basically try to portray our predicament in Iraq as part of a larger ideological struggle that pits we, the free world, against Islamo-fascists.
Do you think there is no larger ideological struggle surrounding Iraq?
Actually, Tom, I do. I do believe based on everything that I have done in terms of research, that there are minorities in both camps, in the Muslim camp and in the Western camps, who are basically beating the drums of a cultural and civilizational clash. Tiny minorities, and they're powerful minorities. But I would argue, too, that huge constituencies in both camps, people who I really would like to build bridges, try to understand each other, try to reduce the cultural misunderstanding. What we hear, what we have been hearing in the last few years, basically it's the rhetoric and the drum beating of minorities in both camps, and it's tragic that the president of the United States, the greatest military, political, and cultural power in the world, would basically play into the hands of a tiny minority in the Muslim world.
Stephen Schwartz, what do you say to that, that there are lots of people ready to build bridges here, and instead this language, the president's language, Fawaz Jirsa says, may drive people from that center into extremes?
Well, I would say that since my Center for Islamic Pluralism has as our main goal building bridges between what I would call normal Muslims, normal Christians, and normal Jews, for us to refer to the radical enemy as Islamofascism is not dividing us from mainstream or traditional Muslims. We are trying to mobilize mainstream, traditional, and even conservative Muslims against the Islamofascists.
Does this phrase help do that?
Yes, it does. It does in Bosnia. It does in Indonesia. It does in Kazakhstan. It does in many other places. As I said, the phrase emerged from a discussion among Muslim intellectuals. It did not emerge from a discussion by GOP strategists.
Michael Parenti, do you see this as helping here? Michael Parenti, do you see this as helping divide Islamist extremists from mainstream Muslims? Michael?
No, I don't see that. The use of these terms?
Yes.
No, I don't. And I think there's a certain hypocrisy. The rhetoric is heating up, and yet Bush's effort and war is actually de-escalating. He's cutting and running in Afghanistan. Development projects have all been abandoned. He's cutting back on the troops in Afghanistan. In Kabul, people are still getting killed. Just yesterday, 7 people were killed. I'm very aware of that because my son is in Kabul right now. The security problem is worse than ever. The Taliban, who are the most extremist, most repressive, most intolerant, most obnoxious and violent group, are resurging, and he's doing very little about it.
We've got a lot of listeners who want to join us. Josiah is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Josiah, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, very well. What do you think?
Well, I have a real problem with the labeling with Islam in general. It seems to me that we're just creating more enemies to jump into this, and we're making it seem like a holy war. We're separating the Christians from the Islamists, and it just seems to me that we're just going to have more people jump on that ship, and we're going to just creating more enemies.
You create more enemies than you carve out by using this language, you're afraid?
Right.
Let's put it to Fawaz Jirsa. Fawaz, as a purely practical matter, what about the deployment of Islamofascism as a phrase, a framing?
First of all, I want to thank the caller for raising this particular critical point. I mean, I think the president keeps saying that we want to win the war, the so-called war on terror. And I think if the president really is genuine and serious about winning the war on terror, the worst label the president can use is the so-called other Islamofascism or Islamofascists. Why? First of all, because in the minds of many Arabs and Muslims, and by the way, some of us who travel extensively in the Arab and Muslim world, we spend long periods of time in the Muslim world, realize that in the eyes of majorities of Arabs and Muslims, the term Islamofascism means a crusade against Arabs and Muslims. So in this particular sense, if the president is trying to win hearts and minds, if the president is trying to basically co-opt the middle ground in the Muslim world, I think this is the worst phrase to use. And secondly, Tom, no one is suggesting that Al-Qaeda is not dangerous. No one is suggesting that the president should not really hammer away at Al-Qaeda. But remember, at the height of its power, Al-Qaeda did not number more than 10,000 seasoned fighters, according to the CIA and all Western security forces. Why lump Al-Qaeda?
which perpetrated a great crime against America with entire Muslim and social movements in the region.
You're saying at the height of its powers, you're looking all the way back to the Soviet time in Afghanistan, I guess.
No, the late 1990s.
Okay.
I mean, 10,000 fighters who basically subscribed to al-Qaeda. Tom, the larger point is the following. In the minds of many Americans, how many Americans make distinctions between Islamofascists ala al-Qaeda and Islam and fascism? There's a real danger here that the president basically playing into the hands of those minorities in the Muslim world and in the Western world, and by indirectly, unwittingly, bringing about the so-called clash of civilization, which Osama bin Laden wanted to bring about in the first place.
By parking those words so close, nestling them right up against one another, Vladimir's calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Vladimir. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm all right. What do you think of this debate, Vladimir?
I think to fight an enemy, you need to name the enemy. And the war on terror, it's not an enemy. Terrorists have been before and terrorists forever. So you need to understand that it's a war of ideology. I am from Soviet Union. And the Soviet ideology, communist ideology, to spread communism all around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
The same had been Hitler. Hitler said, he would like to create new world order.
So you're sympathetic to the president. You're saying he has to name it something. Let's use this.
To the president, because who knows who are the terrorists? You need to name the enemy.
You got to name the enemy. Michael Parenti, what do you say to that? The president believes there's a global threat. He has to call it something. This resonates.
I just want to point out again the enormous gap between the propaganda that he puts out, the constant rhetoric, and his actual actions. The way he played on 9/11 and never did a thing, never looked the other way, never responded to the August 6 memo. Stephen talked about the Wahhabism, a repressive extremist Sunni movement. Well, it's strongest in Saudi Arabia, which is a U.S. ally. They call bin Laden, Bush just called bin Laden another Hitler. Well, he forgets that the U.S. created bin Laden during the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan and was in bed with bin Laden.
So how do you interpret what's going on then? Why? Why is he using it?
I think it's a failed policy. It's a dismally failed policy. And what you do to justify this floundering policy is you conjure up threat to get support from the people. You say you are under threat. You are being menaced by this terrible thing. And to establish that menace, you hype up the rhetoric and you keep demonizing this enemy. And by the way, I'm not saying these maniacs in Iraq right now who are killing each other in this sectarian war that's developed. I'm not saying they're anybody's heroes. They're terrible people. But it was the U.S. invasion and occupation that created this situation. And the way you avoid all that is by constantly frightening the people by telling them there's a threat. We heard that with communism. Communists here, communists there. Communists going to get your mama. Watch out for the communists. Constantly, constantly to justify every kind of reactionary and repressive measure that could be instituted. And they're doing the same thing now with Islamo-fascism.
Stephen Schwartz, Michael Parenti, you hear his criticism. Fawaz Jirja says, you're spreading this so broadly that you are alienating the very people in the Islamic world that you need to have on your side. Now, you say otherwise. So here we are with, you know, two of our experts with just opposite interpretations. How do you put some meat on the bones of your assertion that this is not offending Muslims broadly and creating more enemies than it's boxing away?
Well, I do a lot of traveling in the Muslim world as well. I spend about half of the year in the Muslim world. And at places like the Islamic Faculty of Sarajevo, which is one of the most distinguished Islamic madrasas in the world, at places like the headquarters of the Muhammadiyya and Nadlatul Ulama movements in Indonesia, which together have 60 million members and are, in fact, the largest Muslim movements in the world.
Pretty far from Cairo
and elsewhere,
and Mecca and Kabul.
And lots of other places. Mecca is right now, Mecca and Jeddah in Saudi Arabia are two places where my book is circulating, which put forward the theory of Islamofascism. The analysis of Islamofascism are circulated in Samizdat editions. I receive daily emails from people in both places.
Are you suggesting by that that Muslims are going to rally around this, say, yes, President Bush, you're right, and we want to fight this together with you?
Mainstream, normal, traditional, and conservative Muslims who want the religion of Islam to be a normal religion accept and, in fact, participated in originating the concept of Islamofascism.
Why is it Samizdat, then? Why is it underground? Why is it Samizdat in that case? Why is it underground?
Well, Saudi Arabia, everything is Samizdat except the handouts of the government. But it's not Samizdat in Bosnia. It's not Samizdat in Indonesia. It's not Samizdat in lots of other places, but it is in Saudi Arabia.
Fawaz, what do you say?
Well, this is nonsense. I think this is what I call part of cultural tourism, research tourism, what I call people who visit a few days. Some of us who reside
I lived for two years in Bosnia, Fawaz. I was not a tourist.
Stephen, please.
Some I lived in two for 2 years in Bosnia. Do not call me a cultural tourist.
We've got the numbers, but please.
We follow the scene very closely. Some of us who do surveys in the region.
Well, I won't sit here and be called a cultural tourist.
We got the point, Stephen.
Let me finish. Some of us who basically read Arabic, the press on a daily basis in the morning, realize.
I have a staff that reads the Arabic press on a daily basis.
Stephen, please, we've got it.
Realize that the phrase itself resonates deeply and negatively in the imagination of Arabs and Muslims. In fact, one of the leading commentators in the Arab world a few days ago, I don't know if you read his commentaries every day, Abdel Bari Atwan, said the only fascist in the world today is the president of the United States and the neoconservatives, even though Abdel Bari Atwan is a radical, secular commentator. But I can tell you, even some of the liberal voices in the Arab world, like Hazem Sagheer and the dozen Ahmad Baydoun and others, and Adonis, the leading famous Arab poet, basically view this particular term. And Stephen, if you read Adonis, one of the most secular Arab leading poets in the Arab world, tell you that this particular phrase is seen by Adonis and liberal voices in the Arab world as basically a crusade, an onslaught against Islam and Muslims and Arabs.
I can see.
To suggest that in Mecca, your book is being circulated because you advocate or you advance the notion of Islamofascism is a great distortion of how public opinion in the Arab world and the Muslim world views this particular concept. And it's people like you, Stephen, who basically led us to Iraq, led us to the shifting sands of Iraq, and in fact are heightening and intensifying the anti-American sentiments.
This is just pure demagoguery, and it's personalized.
I don't know what's demagoguery.
And I see no reason why I should have to put up
with it. We're not going to fill this chasm. I think we see both sides of that, and we're not going to fill this chasm here right now, but I want to get our listeners in as well.
Karen is calling from...
Let me make one point.
No, I'm going to bring in...
Tom?
Yeah, you guys, yes?
Tom, can I...
Wasgerges is a Christian, and he has no idea how people read my book in Saudi Arabia.
Well, I believe he may have some idea. We take your point as well. Let's turn to a caller to see if we can steady the boat here a little bit. Waterloo, Iowa. Karen is calling. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Wow, that was quite a melee. Thank you for taking my call.
It's good to have you.
I'm going to be as brief as I can, but I need to expound a little bit. I'm Scotch-Irish and a practicing Mahayana Buddhist.
Okay.
My son is an active military member who served in Afghanistan.
All right.
And he goes to an Assembly of God. My other son is Catholic, and my daughter just gave birth to the most beautiful child named Amir that ever walked the earth, and he is Muslim. And it scared me in Iowa when they named my grandchild Amir.
Because
of that kind of mud-sling, cruel, hate-filled name-calling. He's half Bosnian, and he's half American. And his father is here legally, and his family is productive. And they...
What do you want to hear the president say, if not Islamofascism?
The president... Well, you know, I pray every day for wisdom and for compassion, because I think that that is the only sort of salvation we're going to have. But I do not believe, what I cannot tolerate, is a president who, when we have so many productive members of society of all races, in my house, the one rule is you can come to my house and it is a safe place. It doesn't matter what God you worship, what your beliefs are, as long as you are respectful and gracious towards the other individuals who are there.
Karen, we hear that, and we wish your grandson Amir well, and we hear the fear around the labels that could come on here. It's a tough world at the same time, but, gosh, we can't help but feel supportive of where you stand there. Thanks for calling. Let me get a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Paul is on the line. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. If not Islamofascist, what should they be called? Many of them refer to Jews as monkeys and Christians as infidels. So, you know, what term should we use?
Okay, let's pick that up. My dear guest, let us look at that very calmly,
Tom,
here. Michael Parenti, first to you, and I'd like to get an answer to what Paul asks here. I mean, the president needs to present what's going on somehow. What do you think would be the best way? You don't like Islamofascists.
Tom, I think the president's problem about what terms to grope for are anchored in a White House policy that is the real problem. That policy is creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you take people who are facing really oppressive material conditions and you destroy their democratic revolutionary path, as was done in Iraq by the CIA, who put in Saddam Hussein in there, or was done in Guatemala and El Salvador, and then you destroy the conservative nationalist self-defining system that Saddam put in, you destroy that too. The only thing they got left is they moved toward a Muslim sectarian fundamentalist militant approach, and two different groups who are now busy killing each other.
We acknowledge your take on history. We see it, but now we do have this conflict. So how does the president lead effectively? How would you have him frame it?
I would have him talk to, if he were a different president, he'd have him talk to the American people and tell them what a failure and what a terrible thing this policy is and how it has been serving the oil interests and been serving the neoconservative empire builders, but hasn't been serving the American people and hasn't been serving the people of the Middle East, that's why they hate us. If you read what Bin Laden is saying, he doesn't say we're going to make war against you because you're infidels and we hate you. He says, you leave us alone. If you leave us alone, we will leave you alone. Our war of terrorism against you is a retaliation against your war of terrorism that you've been doing against us, stealing our resources, destroying
our culture.
I've read
that, and I think I've read a bit more as well. Stephen Schwartz, you do go for the Islamofascism label. Are there limits to the utility of that? Do you acknowledge a downside or not?
I'd like to point out, by the way, that my book was issued as an official Islamic document of the Bosnian Islamic Scholars. So
duly noted.
The point is Wahhabism, Al-Qaeda, the Saudi monarchy, to a very limited extent, certain Shia phenomena can be described in a narrow, precise, serious way as Islamofascist. The Saudi monarchy is an ally of the United States. It is now undergoing a transition away from that regime. I'm hoping that will be successful. But I do think it is necessary to draw a line within the Muslim Ummah and in the world between Islam as a normal religion and the state ideology of the Saudi monarchy, Wahhabism. Mm. And the fact is, Bin Laden was not created by the United States. Bin Laden came into Afghanistan after the war with Russia was over. Bin Laden was created by his family and his rich backers in Saudi Arabia and by a wing of the Saudi monarchy.
With that, we're nearly out of time. Fawaz Jirjiz, how would you frame it, my friend?
I very easily, in my two books, Tom, The Far Enemy and Journey of the Jihadist, I made many nuances and complexities about this Islamist phenomenon. You have the ultra-jihadist, the ultra-militant Islamists like Osama bin Laden. You have mainstream Islamists like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which represents about 90%, 95% of the Islamist movement. You have enlightened Islamists. You have progressive Islamists.
That's a mouthful for a president on the stump. How does he boil it down, or can he?
We are, Tom, he can tell the American people we are facing a tiny minority of ultra-militant jihadists or terrorists like Osama bin Laden, but yet the majority of mainstream Muslims and mainstream and progressive Islamists basically oppose this particular nihilistic ideology. There's no trick here, Tom. It's very easy. It can be very easily done.
With that, we're out of time. Fawaz Jirjiz at Sarah Lawrence College, thanks for joining us. Michael Parenti in Berkeley, California today, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And Stephen Schwartz, contributor to the Weekly Standard, executive director of the Center for Islamic Pluralism. Stephen Schwartz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is On Point.